Welcome to the War and Diplomacy podcast, produced by the Centre for War and Diplomacy at Lancaster University. The CWD provides the historical context and strategic analysis to inform understanding of today's geopolitical challenges, promoting discussion through research, teaching, consultancy, and public events.
Hello, I'm Marco Weiss. I'm a reader in international history and security at Lancaster University and the director of the Centre for War and Diplomacy. It's my great pleasure now to be joined by Mark Philip Bradley, Bernadotte E. Schmidt Distinguished Professor, Service Professor of International History and the College, Deputy Dean of Division of the Social Sciences Faculty, the Director of the Posen Family Centre for Human Rights, and the Senior Fellow of the Society of Fellows in the Liberal Arts at the University of Chicago. Mark is the author of The World Reimagined, Americans and Human Rights in the 20th Century, published in 2016, Vietnam at War, published in 2009, and Imagining Vietnam and America, The Making of Post-Colonial Vietnam, published in 2000. This book won the Harry J. Bender Prize from the Association for Asian Studies. He's also the co-editor of Making the Forever War, to be published in 21, Familiar Made Strange, American Icons and Artifacts After the Transnational Turn, published in 2015, Making Sense of the Vietnam Wars, published in 2008, and Truth Claims, Representation and Human Rights, published in 2001. Mark's work has also appeared in the American Historical Review, Journal of American History, the Journal of World History, Diplomatic History, and Dissent. He is a recipient of fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, the American Council of Learned Societies, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and Fulbright Hayes, and he's currently working on a history of the Global South, and we will hopefully talk about this in a little moment, and he also serves as the general editor for the four-volume Cambridge History of America and the World. Mark was recently appointed editor of the American Historical Review to begin in August 21. He served as the elected president of the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations and as co-editor of the Cornell University Press book series, The United States in the World. So thank you very much for joining me today, Mark. It's a great pleasure to have you here to record this podcast. And I will now, without further ado, go to the questions I would like to ask you. So my first question would be, you have worked extensively on the Vietnam Wars, and in so doing, moved the focus away from the United States towards Vietnam and the Vietnamese. What was your motivation behind this analytical shift?
Thanks, Marco, and thanks for inviting me to be a part of this marvelous podcast. It's a real pleasure to have this conversation with you today. And also very nice, that lovely introduction. To go right to your question, you know, why the approach that I took in my first book, I think it's a matter of sort of contextualizing the historical moment. So that book was a 2000 book, but the research for it, in fact, began in the late 80s and early 90s when I was still a doctoral student at Harvard. And it was a moment when we were beginning to rethink post-45 history. And when I say we, I mean, I think graduate students were keen on that project, but it was a project that really moved from senior scholars down to doctoral students. And the story that we had told had been a Cold War story, by and large. And it had been a Cold War story that privileged events in Europe. And so the kind of narrative of what international history looked like in that moment, origins of the Cold War, middle of the Cold War, we didn't know, although we were actually living through the end of the Cold War, tended to have a European inflection point. And I think what people realized was that there was a story of decolonization that was emerging alongside that Cold War story. It wasn't that we didn't know that. People had been telling that story. There were certainly distinguished historians who were working on decolonial history, but those events tended to be separate. And the kinds of people who were working on those events, the kinds of historians who were working on those events, tended, as we do in our field, to be in silos and working one side of the territory, the other side of the territory. So I think what this project was about, in part, was trying to put these two narratives together and to think about what it would mean to look back at what we saw as major inflection points in Cold War history from a decolonizing lens. So with Vietnam, it is part of the Cold War, and it's part of the Cold War in that standard, more Europe and American first story. That's an important dimension of what's going on in understanding Vietnam after 1945, but it is also a decolonizing war. You know, if you think about it, the French are in Vietnam for a long period of time. 1946 to 1954 is essentially a French colonial war that becomes Cold War at the same time, and then an American intervention somewhat later that takes on more Cold War valences, at least for Americans. But it's also a civil war in Vietnam, a civil war of ideas in part about what will guide the post-colonial state as it moves forward. And Cold War is only, you know, a category that's comfortable, I think, in places where it never went hot. So the notion that it was cold in Vietnam, right, where millions of Vietnamese soldiers and civilians were killed, by contrast, and again, this is, you know, a tricky kind of territory to go into, roughly 58,000 Americans died in the war. Order of magnitude, you know, very, very different on both sides in terms of the way in which the war might be felt. And again, Americans coming from the United States to fight a war for Vietnamese, it's happening right in the place that they live. So if you think about those many valences of what the war looks like, it was inevitable, I think, that we needed to come to terms with what the Vietnamese dimensions of the war were in these multiple registers, and then to think about that in connection to larger narratives that we were drawing about the post-45 era. I think the other thing to say here is that to be opening up these questions at the end of one millennium and the beginning of another, just to make it very grand, as historians sometimes do, but, you know, end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, if you want to bring the volume down a little bit. The Cold War, as we saw it traditionally, was coming to an end. You know, the fall of Eastern Europe, the dissolution of the Soviet Empire. But in Asia, that picture was more complicated. How did the Cold War come to an end in China? How did the Cold War come to an end in North Korea? How did the Cold War come to an end exactly in Vietnam? And there, I think somebody like Hanuk Kwan, who talks about the fact that it's a decomposition rather than an end, that might be a way of thinking about what that moment looks like, makes more sense. But you know, back in 1989, 1990, Hanuk wasn't on the scene to talk about decomposition, and we were just trying to figure out what was going on around us in one form or another. So it was a moment of rupture in 89, 90. And I think that helped me think about kind of 45 to 54, which was also a moment of rupture. And more particularly, if you're thinking kind of 45 to 48, really, what's happening in Vietnam. So a sense that you could be in the place. I was lucky to be one of the first Americans to go back and do research at the end of the 1980s and watch the way in which the Vietnamese were navigating yet another rupture in their lives. I think indirectly helped me think about the earlier period in different sorts of ways.
Thank you very much. Yes, that's fascinating. I mean, also this interaction, of course, between decolonization and the Cold War, which were to a large extent contemporaneous, and also, of course, the different Cold War endings, depending on the period and the so-called hotness or coldness of the Cold War, depending on a region or a localized conflict. So you mentioned that you could go to Vietnam to do your research at a very interesting juncture. And that brings me to my next question. So in studying the wars in Vietnam from the Vietnamese perspective, what were then the sources you used and could use, and what ultimately were your main findings?
Well, that was an interesting moment in terms of sources as well. So scholars outside of the region who had been able to do some work in Vietnam in the post-war period, it tended to be French scholars, later Australian scholars, and then some Eastern European scholars, particularly before the wall came down. And that was kind of the international scholarly community within Hanoi. And my work was primarily in Hanoi for this project. And what had emerged was that oral history was a set of things that people were interested and willing to do. You know, at that moment, some of the people who were involved in some of the most important events of the World War II era and the early French War period we're getting to be quite old. Vanuen Zap was about 90, I think, when I was there. Vanuen Zap is the Vietnamese general who defeats the French at Dien Bien Phu. And in fact, it was the 200th anniversary of Bastille Day in 1989. And I was at the French embassy listening to Vanuen Zap give his address about what he thought were the meanings of the French Revolution for the Vietnamese, which was, you know, a kind of wonderful moment. But this notion that there were older people passing from the scene who I think were keen to talk to people. They were keen to talk to other researchers. Some of them were keen to talk to me as well. And those were some, I think, of the most marvelous conversations I had in Vietnam in that period. You know, when you do oral history, and this has probably been true for you too, Marco, it doesn't come into the book often as directly as you might think. There are parts where actual interview quotes would structure some of what I was saying. But in a way, it was helping to kind of read time and place with printed sources. And it gave me a window and a way of thinking about those sources that was really quite different than I would have had otherwise. So Vietnamese libraries were increasingly open as well. And there, you know, my book was looking really at a bigger swath than the 45 to 55, 54 period. It was really going back to essentially the beginning of the 20th century, but say 1919 into the 1950s. And so a part of what I was trying to do was to figure out, had Americans thought about Vietnamese before World War II? And during World War II, I knew that they had, but trying to figure out a little bit more about what that might have looked like. And similarly, what had the Vietnamese thought about Americans to the extent that they might have? Most people know, you know, Ho's famous letter to Woodrow Wilson in 1919, asking that at the Paris Peace Conference that some kind of reform, sort of decolonial reform began to happen in Vietnam. That's a moment that passes quite quickly. And in fact, Ho moves to communism after that moment. But again, where did that larger set of why go to the Americans? What kind of expectations would you have of the Americans? So to get my head around that, I felt like I needed to be reading books and periodicals from particularly the 1920s and 1930s, although I read a little bit before that, to get a sense about where anti-colonial intellectual elites were coming from when they were thinking about the United States and the kind of perspective that they were putting America in. And so those were largely at that period, books and periodicals that were not available in the United States. Some of them were available in France, and I'd been in France before I came to Hanoi, so I had a good sense about what Bibliothèque Nationale had in that regard. And in some ways, very, very extensive, because there was a rule during the colonial period that every approved volume by the state, one of them went to Bibliothèque Nationale. So again, the collection was strong. But inevitably, there was all kinds of stuff that hadn't made its way to Paris, or if it had made its way to Paris, it never got cataloged or wasn't there. And so triangulating in a way between what was in Library of Congress, not so much, what was in Bibliothèque Nationale, quite a lot, and then what was in the National Library in Vietnam, also quite a lot. It was a way of kind of thinking about what the ideascape of the Vietnamese was in that period of time. Museums were helpful for that too sometimes, some of the museum collections that I was able to use. Now, archives was a much more complicated situation then and now, really. At that point, the archives were open, but, you know, open with kind of scare quotes around it. And any files that I would have found most interesting for my work, so if you were looking for files that would have been around the office of the president, the office of the premier, the foreign affairs ministry, all closed. In Vietnam, the Ministry of Interior operates a little bit differently than the Ministry of Interior does, or the Department of Interior does in the United States. And so actually, Ministry of Interior materials could have been potentially interesting. Those largely not open as well. So there was some public stuff that was available. And we were all, there were, you know, this kind of motley group of us from, you know, I don't know, Poland, Australia, France, the United States, trying to do the best we could with what was there, but the access was not great. Now, fast forward to now, roughly, that has not changed much in Hanoi. The access to the archives in Hanoi is pretty limited. What has changed radically, and this was not open to us in the late 1980s, were the Southern archives. So the Southern archives that had the ZM stuff, the TIA stuff, you know, the independent Associated States under Bao Dai. They're all in Archives 3 in Ho Chi Minh City. And in a way, the regime just doesn't care. You know, those are failed regimes that were gone. They weren't really vetting those all that much. That's come up and down a little bit over time, but people have had remarkable access down south to be able to think the story of Southern Vietnamese politics in really sophisticated ways. So in my world, it was a pretty Hanoi-focused world, and the scholars at that moment in time were largely focused up north. The second wave of this, which has been really fascinating, has been people working working it really hard down south. And so people like Ed Miller and his book on ZM, you know, just marvelously using these materials from the Vietnamese side that people haven't been able to use. Again, it's not just Ed, there's probably a dozen people who have been working that material in an interesting way. So it's about stages, you know. In that earlier period, nobody was going to put us down in Saigon or Ho Chi Minh City. Everything was Hanoi focused, and those were essentially the materials that we were working with. So, you know, in broad brushstrokes, the argument is simply that, in fact, the Vietnamese and the Americans did think quite a bit more about one another than one might have thought, but that those images or those perceptions had different kinds of effects on policy on both sides. On the American side, what you see is a very early sense of a kind of inferiority of the Vietnamese. So that sort of orientalized notion, you know, more broadly that Said and others talk about in their work. But in the specific context of Vietnam, that there were sort of hierarchies of inability. And the Vietnamese sat quite low for Americans in that. So in fact, the Chinese, who, if you were just reading materials about Americans and Chinese in this period, you know, there would be a lot of unflattering sorts of things that would have been said about the Chinese. The Vietnamese were seen as sort of a lesser version of the Chinese. That's often almost literally what one reads in the text. And so it had policy implications. So for instance, in the end of World War II, Franklin Roosevelt quite famously suggests that trusteeship might be a way of bridging the difference between colonialism and a post-colonial state. Not just in Vietnam, he's talking about this in other places as well. Korea is another example. But what's really interesting is if you see, so, you know, Roosevelt just thought big ideas up and then sent them off to somebody else to figure out how to do it. And so the State Department's got to figure out, well, what would that mean if we actually had some kind of trusteeship in a place like Vietnam? And those papers, fascinating papers, which basically show you that the State Department thought, we could do that, but it would be 30 years before you could take the trusteeship off. It would take 30 years of sustained tutelage of the Vietnamese before they would be capable of independent rule. Well, why do you think that? You know, the people who were collected around the State Department, and these were mid-level State Department people. So it was just, these were kind of the assumptions that people had in their heads. Those assumptions were easier to unpack in this interwar set of writings about, you know, where people thought the Vietnamese were in this sort of larger, you know, racialist and orientalist notion about capabilities. So moving back and forth, 20s to 40s, that kind of thing helped me and I think helped to make a stronger and deeper argument. On the Vietnamese side, there is in some ways a kind of idealization of American political figures. So you get these really great kind of primers for school children in the 1920s. And it's a genre of biography that just explodes in Vietnam in the 1920s. And they're not just talking about American figures. They're talking about, you know, world leaders of one sort or another all over the place. But they're biographies of Lincoln and they're biographies of Washington. And again, they're didactic. So there'll be a chapter, it'll tell a little chunk of Lincoln's life. And then the end of it will say, these are the qualities that Mr. Lincoln showed in this incident. And these are the qualities that as young Vietnamese, we can begin to inculcate in ourselves so that we can move forward, you know, more successfully into the post-independence era. Again, not all about Lincoln. There are plenty of biographies. Napoleon is in the mix, Florence Nightingale is in the mix, so it's eclectic, Gandhi is in the mix, Chiang Kai-shek is in the mix. But again, the notion that there are these biographical figures, including American figures who are pushing people on. So in a sense, with the Vietnamese, there is a notion that there's something there that they want to take and perhaps is useful for them. and that it might help to explain the hopefulness in 1945 that in fact a relationship was possible with the Americans. That quite quickly is not the case and is quite obvious to the Vietnamese in one form or another. But that period, 1944, 45, 46, is a kind of liminal moment where it's not clear what's coming. And how do you understand that? You know, and I don't think it's just that the Vietnamese are naive. I think it's that it really was a moment where it was not clear where American policy would go, what international order would look like. The Vietnamese are trying to figure that out just like everybody else is. And again, these are some of the ways that inform how they think about that.
Thank you. Yes, it's always easier in hindsight to see that once you're in a situation, of course, the outlook is completely different. And as historians, we always have to keep that in mind, of course. So following up on this question, so more generally then, how can this kind of scholarship, so taking also the other perspective into account, contribute to a more multidimensional popular perspective on the Vietnam War, so inform a more general understanding of history?
That's a great question. You know, I think, again, if you were looking at American film about Vietnam, and that's been one of the classic places that people have gone to think about popular perceptions of the war, and I'm sure many who are listening know Apocalypse Now, Deer Hunter, you know, these big Hollywood films that were made about the war. But they were made, again, largely about the experiences of American soldiers in Vietnam, or the American experience writ large in Vietnam. And what we've seen over the last 10 odd years are people in a variety of popular forms working a more complex terrain about who are actors in Vietnam, whose experiences we need to understand. So if you think about video and documentary film, for instance, Ken Burns' recent Vietnam documentary, you know, one of his big multi-part things, it goes to Vietnamese experiences in the plural of the war. And I think that's been one important part of this. There is not a Vietnamese experience of war. You know, if you're North, if you're South, that's different. If you're a man, if you're a woman, that's different. If you're a soldier, a civilian, I mean, there's just multiple ways to think about how that might come down. And that Burns is sensitive to that in putting together that documentary. More so, for instance, than a documentary that was made, famous one by Stanley Karnow, now, gosh, almost 30 years ago, interviewing very high-level Vietnamese in that kind of talking head sort of way, but not thinking about the sort of the experience of war writ large in the kinds of ways that Burns does. And I think that's part of this larger trend. It isn't just about high policy making, it's thinking about the war on the ground. You think about Meredith Laird's wonderful book about how the everyday lives of military soldiers and their families are in Vietnam, right? And this is American focused, but still much more experiential. Spike Lee's new movie about African-American veterans returning back to Vietnam. Again, focusing on a swath of important figures in terms of how the war was fought. Disproportionately, there are more people of color fighting in Vietnam than, given the general level in the population, there you might have expected. And so they play an outsized role, but not a role that we've thought that much about. And that film takes that up. You think about historical fiction, Viet Thanh Nguyen's Pulitzer Prize winning The Sympathizer, that is now probably just as frequently assigned in classes as some of, you know, the sort of Graham Greene kind of classic Quiet American sort of thing. So suddenly a Vietnamese American author talking about the experience in very, very different ways than Graham Greene, having a kind of platform and having a kind of audience that would be hard to have imagined even 10 years ago. So that sort of sphere, I think the way in which popular notions of the war are talked about are just fundamentally expanded. I think the other way that there's a bigger canvas for thinking about the war right now, and this may be more in a kind of academic institutional realm, although I think it blows into kind of popular perceptions as well, is what's the frame that you put around the war? So we were talking earlier about its multiple wars and how do we think about it in that kind of context. But what if we take it out of just the post-45 period and we try to think about it in a kind of larger narrative of interventions, military interventions in one form or another? And so one way, at least in the United States, that I've seen Vietnam being taught. And it used to be that we had these enormous Vietnam War courses. And in some cases, we still do have quite large, well-subscribed Vietnam War courses. But just as common now would be a kind of Asian Wars of the 20th Century course. So you would start with the Boxers, you know, and you might go all the way through Vietnam. Or if you want to think about Afghanistan as like one far, far corner of Asia, you might be able to go all the way there too. And you've got the Chinese Civil War, you've got Korea, you've got World War II, you know, you've got a lot in the mix. So you're thinking about it in that bigger lens and what its meanings might be in that bigger lens. The other place that I think has changed the space for thinking about Vietnam has been this notion of forever war since 9/11. And there are a number of people who are kind of associated with thinking about that. Andrew Bracevich is one. Mary Dudziak is another. And Marilyn Young, who died a couple of years ago, is another person who has kind of occupied that space. And Mary Dudziak and I are just in the process of finishing editing a volume of Marilyn's writings. And one thing that you can see there is Marilyn, who was very much focused on Korea and Vietnam through most of her career. She started with the Boxers, but she went quite quickly in those spaces. Then spends the last 10, 15 years of her career thinking about the implications of American decision-making in those spaces for this new period that we think of as forever war. And so how it's in a sense a genealogy for the present. So again, you wouldn't have thought 10, 20 years ago about Vietnam in that kind of way. But now I think it's operating in that space as well.
Thank you. Yes, fascinating. The impact scholarship can ultimately also have on popular perceptions. And of course, we were much looking forward to the book edited by you and Mary Dudziak of the writings by Marilyn Young. Now, you have also carried out research in other areas, of course, and I would like now to move on to the next big area of your research, which is human rights, a key area of your research. So in relation to this, I'd like to ask, so numerous US governments have generally upheld the United States' role as the guarantor and even founder of modern human rights. And that's something one can perceive, of course, in official US discourse. Do you think this can actually be justified?
I don't, actually. But I think, again, it's one of those historians' answers, well, yes and well, no. If you looked at the 1940s and you looked at the moment, essentially, that the UN is founded and the foundational way in which human rights and human rights norms become embedded, not just in the Charter, but also in the Universal Declaration in 1948, there is clearly strong American leadership that's involved in that project. Now, I would say even there, American leadership, but a shared kind of leadership. And one of the interesting things that happens in the 1940s is how diverse, in fact, the groups are at the United Nations who are advocating for this. So you have Latin American states who are close partners in this. And in fact, given the constitutions of Latin American states over the interwar period, particularly interested in social and economic rights in a way that the United States never has been in terms of international human rights guarantees. Some strong voices from South Asia coming in this period as well. And then also, you know, it's a complicated thing for European governments in this period of time. I mean, as you're negotiating out in Europe, what will become the European Convention, always the fear about where is colonialism in the mix, and that if you go too far forward, are you setting yourself up with a mechanism that might come back after you around colonialism? So there's a kind of muted level of British and French support at the UN, but it's there to a certain extent, as long as it's tightly wound around political and civil rights. But again, I would say that the Americans really do play a leadership role in bringing those forces together. So that's the origin story for claims now that we essentially are who the world can thank for human rights. The actual historical story is a much more complicated one and a much less celebratory one, in the sense that the air kind of goes out of the tires for international human rights in the United States as early as the 1950s. There is a huge blowback around conservative Republicans, both Southerners and Northerners, in the 1950s around international human rights norms and the kind of work that they might do in a domestic political space. And it's all about the civil rights movement and the rise of the civil rights movement and the fears of that movement's strength. And so the United Nations and international human rights norms get tarred as, well, it's socialistic, it's this, you know, world government, it's this. And by 1953, they're able to put so much pressure on Eisenhower that he's got to send his Secretary of State to a Senate hearing and say, you know, those treaties and norms and all, we're not going to do that anymore. We're done with that. Don't worry about that. Could we just get this issue off the table? And essentially, it marks a major withdrawal in the ways in which Americans are thinking about human rights. But the other twist in the story that I think is even more interesting is, in fact, there are civil rights groups in the United States who are using treaty language hard to push claims for civil rights. This is why conservatives are so exercised by it. So African Americans, largely through the NAACP, but other groups as well, Japanese Americans and Native Americans, pushing a series of court cases in this period of time around a whole series of kinds of discrimination. So around housing, around education, around voting. And essentially the arguments always in part are constitutionally based, but they're also leaning really heavily on the fact that the UN is a signatory, or the United States is a signatory to the charter, and that there's some guarantees that are made in the charter. And judges are starting to hear some of those cases favorably. Never goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court never says, yes, that's right, you know, the charter and international human rights norms, that should drive these sorts of things. But there are plenty of courts along the way where they suggest that's so. When the pressure gets put on Eisenhower to evacuate the language, the pressure really is a form of McCarthyism. And so, you know, in a sense, to run with that language in the middle of McCarthyism was now to be tarred by communism. And I think a lot of groups strategically decided they were going to evacuate the language too, that it couldn't do the political work that it had been doing for them right after the war was over. And now they needed to move back into a kind of domestic realm. That's not to say that human rights doesn't come up now and again in the ways in which civil rights leaders are talking. It comes up famously at points for Martin Luther King. It comes up even more famously for figures like Malcolm X. But it is in general in a kind of minor key in thinking about rights questions in the 1960s and 1970s. So when Carter finds human rights again and American leadership about human rights suddenly lifts up, there's a lot of education work to do. There's this hearing that goes on in the House, again, Carter era hearing, where the representatives, they don't really know about these treaties from the earlier period. Or if they know, it's only in the vaguest sort of terms. So they have like little seminars, essentially, where they import like a figure from England who's running Amnesty at that period to just kind of walk them through and say, well, yes, in fact, there were all these things and you were engaged in that kind of way. And they said, interesting. So they kind of have to be retutored in a sense about where the Americans were in this early period of time. And then it picks up, obviously, in particular ways around Carter and comes forward. But the fact that it does in that kind of way suggests that from the 70s onward, it is a pluralistic project across a variety of states. And, you know, sometimes American policy is inconsistent about human rights, just as it is about many things. But the idea of a kind of, you know, leadership or it sort of put it out there, you know, that just doesn't sustain the way in which it emerged. And I think that the way I was most struck when I was working on the book, I was in Ireland doing some talks, and you know, there, the Irish Center of Human Rights, you know, it was just fundamentally, everything was around the Declaration, the European Convention, that, you know, it was a fundamental document by which people were thinking about rights in that context. And I think that's true in many spaces in Western Europe, at least still. It never is here. You know, it's come back in a sense under Trump in ways that are surprising, and it does seem to be doing some political work for more progressive groups, but it has never had the domestic kind of valence in the United States that it does in a Western Europe. So in Europe, it both works domestically and it works as a rhetorical strategy outside. In the United States, at best, it has worked as a rhetorical strategy about other people violating human rights. and very seldom as a strategy for political change in the country itself.
Fascinating. Yeah, so often the domestic and the foreign policy perspective in the United States are quite different, at least from an outside perspective. You hinted at it to some extent in your answers when you sort of discussed a more, you know, the role of other actors in human rights in other countries. So, and in your research on human rights, you have adopted, therefore, a global approach. And I was wondering what motivated you in this, and how does this allow you to further our understanding of human rights?
Well, I think the book that I wrote looks really quite intensively at both the 1940s and the 1970s, and tries to make sense of those kind of different moments. And so if the 40s is a moment of leadership, then it's collapsed leadership quite quickly. And then the 70s question becomes, you know, how does it come back? And what I realized quite quickly in the 70s is that it comes back almost everywhere else first before the United States. That the United States in some ways is late to the table in this kind of reprise of human rights politics in the 1970s. And again, this notion of the 70s as the kind of fulcrum for international human rights politics is now kind of baked into how people think about the human rights field, which still, it should be said, the history of human rights has only really been written for about the last 10 years. But at the moment, the 70s, you know, this period, partially through Sam Moyn's work, but partially through others who are working kind of in that framework, the 70s were getting a deeper and thicker sense of what it meant to talk about global human rights in that period. Again, it seems to me the Americans are quite slow to come to that as a conception that they see as doing work in the world. And what I was trying to do in my book was less think about diplomats, congresspeople. Barbara Keyes does a really wonderful job with that in her book on the 1970s with human rights. And I was just trying to think about why more ordinary people found human rights to be believable in both the 40s and the 1970s. And there, it seems to me that the global was essential in more everyday understandings of human rights. So just keep it in the 1970s. So many of the people who come into Amnesty in the United States in the 1970s come from the anti-war movement into Amnesty, come from anti-war activism into human rights activism. And so that sphere of anti-war activism had already opened up progressives to a kind of global sphere. And that opening up then transfers in some ways into this sort of human rights lens as well. But I think also there is a kind of circulation of cultural products, just to give it a kind of big broad brushstroke way of thinking about it, that come into people's lives. So let me bring that down and make that clearer. Alexander Solzhenitsyn's work, Gulag Archipelago, those big three volumes of the Gulag Archipelago that many good liberals had on their coffee tables in the 1970s. Whether the good liberals actually read all 1,800 pages of the Gulag, not so sure, but you know how that goes. But it was a fixture in the ways in which people thought about what human rights might mean. The Soviet gulags, as Solzhenitsyn began to articulate them for people. Or Andrei Sakharov in that period of time, winning the Nobel Prize. Again, lots of prominence for thinking about what dissidents in the Soviet East might mean in terms of human rights. And that's a sphere where it's not just liberals, but it's also conservatives are coming to think about human rights as the frame to think about the Soviet Union in one form or another. The other big place in the 70s where human rights language is coming from is Latin America. So it's really, I think, around the Soviet East and the Latin America that, again, it's political, but it's also cultural in shaping Americans' notions about why it is that way of thinking about problems in those places, why human rights is a frame that begins to make sense to people. And Amnesty itself is an importation from Great Britain, right? Amnesty is founded in London in 1961. It is not an American organization. There are always tensions between Amnesty USA and Amnesty International. But again, the whole notion, I mean, Amnesty is ground zero for how you do grassroots activism of all kinds of ways, including human rights. That's all coming not out in America for the first time, but an importation in from another place.
This makes it evident why a global approach is necessary. Now, staying with the global, you're currently working on a history of the global South. And what brought you to embark on such a vast project? And why do you think we have to pay more attention to the perspective from the Global South?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one, I think if you're looking at where the international history of the second half of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century is, that we've had this remarkable period over the last 20 years in the historiography that's really rethought the period roughly 1940 to 1970. This is true, I know, in your teaching too, Marco. We don't talk about that era in the same way that we did when you and I were in graduate school. I think now we're moving toward thinking about the late 20th century and the early 21st century and beginning to try to do the same things there. And we're able to do it because, you know, as historians do, time is passing, archives are opening up, that sort of thing. So there's opportunities that weren't there before. But I think there's also a sense of, again, trying to think about the kind of bigger cadences by which international history was working over the course of that period of time. And one thing that's clear is that the Third World became one important marker of what was happening in international society amongst non-Western states and peoples. And I think we've gotten a really remarkable three-dimensional sense about what Third Worldism looks like, something that we didn't have even 10 years ago. But by the time you get to the 1980s and the 1990s, and particularly, you know, with the collapse of the Second World, it's hard to have a third one when one's gone and, you know, that sort of thing, that there really is a sense that something was happening different in those spaces in the latter part of the 20th century, and how we begin to think about what that is. And so this notion of the Global South started to float around, and we all use the Global South now. Oh yes, Global South, Global South, Global South, not knowing necessarily what we mean by the Global South. It's a UN category, it's an analytical category, it has some utility, but it seems to do a kind of work, you know, and trying to think about a sort of intellectual history of what that work is what I'm interested in doing in this project. So one of the things that I want to do, I want to think in the political, economic, and cultural spheres simultaneously. And I want to think about key words that have emerged in this late 20th century era, and key words that have a resonance not just in the Global South, but in the Global North as well. And to talk about the ways in which the Global South fundamentally shaped what those keywords are, so that you avoid this kind of thing that we used to have about, you know, things are imported from the West and into the East, and then the East is trying to figure it out. No, it's not like that. It's multiple back forth, but it's going in all, it's like chaos theory rather than, you know, some sort of impact response kind of thing. So if you think about a word like sustainability, a word you use, I would guess, frequently, I think many who are listening hear it all the time. Resilience, another word, and particularly under COVID, that we've heard, I think, a lot. Or even the notion of capabilities, thinking in broader ways about capabilities, is something that comes out of this period as well. So what I'm doing is trying to look at people in Asia, Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East who are working around some of these concepts and the ways in which they help to kind of put them in place in the world. So the capabilities one may be the least familiar of the three, but this notion that Amartya Sen was involved in the late 1980s, but really runs through his career from the 70s onwards, thinking about development. And you don't think necessarily in terms of per capita development, but you think about, are you creating schemas by which the capabilities of citizens and individuals are augmented in one form or another. Totally different lens by which to think about development than the classic kind of Cold War Green Revolution ways of thinking about that. And that's just one of a number of ways that somehow in the 1970s, there were just a whole host of thinkers across all of these areas who weren't satisfied with the ways in which people had thought out some of these problems in the past and began to unpack what a different way of seeing the world would look like. And those turn out, I think, to have been highly influential around the globe. And so the project in part just trying to capture that moment, how it came about, and giving it some shape and form by thinking around these particular concepts, how they emerge, how they circulate.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And of course, the term Third World One is not really allowed to use anymore, even though it's a historical term when used in historical teaching, and Global South is then a term that has to be used. So it's going to be interesting and very fascinating to learn more about the intellectual dimension behind the idea of Global South. And now you hinted at this already, so because everything is to some extent interwoven, or you mentioned chaos theory, but so how do you see that the Global South relates to the history of the Global North?
Well, I think the place that so far I've been able to tease this out more is in the cultural realm. And I think the challenge of the project going forward for me is going to be thinking about this in kind of more fully developed ways around politics and economics. But in the cultural realm, you have an explosion of kind of cultural institution building around the world in the late 20th century, early 21st century. So cultural capital becoming increasingly important for a variety of states, northern and southern. It is not a situation where the South is catching up with the North. It is a situation that's being kind of co-produced in one form or another. So the art world works largely through these short-term international exhibitions called biennales. They come every 2 years, hence biennale. And, you know, they have remarkable footprints in the cultural world. Those are fundamentally changed in this period of time from largely Euro-American constructions to constructions where the Global South is global culture, you know? And so the artists and the curators who are occupying these spaces, again, completely changed. There are now new institutions being built in places like Singapore and Hong Kong, that their ambition is not to show art from the region. Their ambition is to be the MoMA or the Tate Modern in Asia, right? That they are international cultural institutions of one sort or another. At the same time that cultural institutions in the Global North are having to rethink themselves in fundamental kinds of ways. This whole movement about decolonizing museums in Europe and in the United States means that it isn't out there happening someplace else. It's about fundamentally rethinking the practices by which museums and exhibitions have worked in the West for centuries in many kinds of ways. So again, I think the cultural lens is a really nice place where you can see it in work, but I think you can see it in bricks and mortar in really important ways as well. I was able to put some of those connections together because before COVID, I was able to do quite a lot of traveling, both in Asia and in Europe around these questions. And you know, a lot of this is the oral history kind of stuff that I was doing way back in Vietnam, talking to curators, talking to artists, trying to get a sense in real time of how some of this emerged, as well as some of the state actors who are thinking about, you know, building museums or changing museums in one form or another. I've got to figure out a way to think that out in the political and economic sphere, as I say. I think it's there. I think it's probably going to come together in slightly different ways because every sphere is not working exactly the same. But my hunch is that you do get this kind of constellation where it's just, I mean, for a long time, we believed impact response doesn't really make sense as a way of thinking about these kinds of historical problems. But what it's one thing to say chaos, it's another thing to say, how do you kind of deconstruct chaos a little bit to see what those interlocking, overlapping, intertwined kind of forces are?
Yes, it's absolutely fascinating. And so moving on somehow from the Global South, I don't know whether you're going to stay to some extent in the Global South and the Global North or global history more generally. I was wondering, and you don't, of course, have to answer if you don't want to, but I'd be very glad if you would, is in which direction will your research go after this very large and, you know, intellectually, I think, challenging project on the Global South?
Well, maybe to an unexpected place. I grew up in a town called Flint, Michigan, which until recent years, I don't know that many people would have known very well, but there was a water crisis in Flint over the last 4 or 5 years that brought Flint a kind of notoriety in a bad sort of way. And that's been internationally speaking, so that Flint is now, you know, was ground zero in political campaigns in the way it wouldn't have been before presidential candidates come to Flint. So, you know, Flint has a kind of presence in the world that I never would have thought as I grew up there. Some people who are a little bit older may remember Michael Moore, a documentary filmmaker. Michael Moore's from Flint, and his first film, in fact, that kind of made his career is about the woes of Flint. Flint is a deindustrializing Rust Belt town. It's also a town that's full of racial strife, racial issues, structural racism. It's a town that can tell a story about corporations and firms and their afterlives. It's a town that can talk about environmental history and environmental justice. And I'd like to do something in Flint with both oral history and local archives that use Flint as a way of understanding the American present. And that's not like work that I've done before, which has generally tended not to be based in the United States. But I don't know. You know, I grew up there and the place matters to me. And I think there's a story to be told out of that place that would be one that a lot of people would be interested to hear.
Thank you. Yes, that's very interesting. And often the local can actually throw light on a lot of national or global issues, of course. Well, these were all my questions, and thank you very much for this fascinating discussion, which has allowed me, and I'm certain it will also allow the listeners of this podcast, to gain new and groundbreaking insights into the history of the Vietnam Wars, human rights, and the Global South. So I can only invite the listeners to read Mark's forthcoming book, and of course also all his previously published works. And of course, you can follow up on these books. You will find some information, of course, on various websites and booksellers. And of course, please continue to listen to CWD podcasts, previous one, this one, and of course, future ones. So thank you very much, Mark, for this interview. It's been really fascinating. So thank you very much, and all the best with your current and future projects.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's a great set of conversations that you're staging through this podcast, so it's a real honor to be a part of it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear further podcasts, please visit the CWD website, lancaster.ac.uk/CWD. There you can find more on the CWD's research, events and teaching, including the MA in International and Military History.